Welcome to History, Books, and Wine,
where three author friends talk about books
and fun historical tidbits,
all while raising a glass of vino.
We're your hosts, Lori Ann Bailey,
Eliza Knight,
and Madeline Martin. So, pour a glass and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 2 of the History Books and Wine podcast. This is Eliza Knight, your host for this week. I am a USA Today bestselling author of historical romance, and under my name E. Knight, I write historical fiction. So if you all tuned in last week, you were here for our happy hour, which was myself, Lori Ann Bailey, and Madeline Martin. Each week, we're going to take a podcast for ourselves, followed by the fourth week being our special happy hour with all three of us. So we're really excited to have you all with us on this journey and hope that you enjoy the show. So today, I'm going to be drinking a wine called Carnivore, which is a Cabernet Sauvignon from California, year 2016. I bought this because I love the label. It's black with a slash mark like a claw went through it, which I thought was pretty cool. And sometimes I do buy wine just because the label looks pretty awesome, I admit it. And sometimes they're not that great, but this one, it tastes really good. So I'm glad that worked out for me. The website calls this wine a feast for the glass, and I think that that is absolutely true. It's got a little bit of an oaky flavor, has some notes of cherry, blackberry, and a hint of caramel. So I'm going to pour myself a larger glass and hope you guys are having a little bit of a glass with me. All right. So today's topic that I'm going to be talking about is actually a few places in Scotland that I've been that are fascinating, rich with history, and that I have used in some stories of mine that are already written or stories that are coming to fruition at some point in the next year or two. So I'm going to start first with Dunrobin Castle. This is a really special castle for me because it's the seat of my Sutherland heroes, which have spanned at least three series and over a couple dozen books. I have no end in sight for that series. I just love the characters, and it's been really fun writing them and multiple generations. Anyways, the castle, as it stands today, looks a lot like a fairy tale castle or a French chateau. It's on the east coast of the Northern Highlands and overlooks the Moray Firth, which leads out to the North Sea. It's absolutely stunning. I've been able to walk on the beach there and just to imagine myself as one of the characters in my books looking out at that sea is just incredible, and I hope that I've been able to bring that to life in my own books. I've had the pleasure of visiting the castle twice now, and I'm going to be making another journey there this summer, which I'm super excited about because my family's coming with me, and they've never been before, so they're going to get to see the world that I write about. I'm just super excited about that. So I'm going to take a little sip here. Dunrobin means Robin's Hill, or fort in Gaelic. It may have been named for the past Earl Robert, who lived there back in the 14th century, I believe. While the outside facade is much newer in its fairy tale glory with all the spires and it's just incredible. The fortified square keep, which was built in the medieval era, has been encased by several additions over the years, almost as though each century a new modernized addition was wrapped around the castle, giving it kind of like a layered feel. And when you visit, you can take a tour and actually walk inside the castle on some of the medieval stairs, or at least you could the last time I was there. And that was really cool, just to be like, wow, there's still part of this awesome medieval castle inside this beautiful fantasy castle. So also, if you have a chance to visit, the gardens are incredible and magical. There's a maze, just tons of flowers, roses, all sorts of things that I can't even name because I'm not a flower expert, but they are literally beautiful. And I have some pictures on my website. I lead you to a link in the show notes for that. There's also a pet cemetery, which always makes me cry whenever I see it because I love animals. And in the pet cemetery, they have their dogs and horses and things like that from past people that lived there. And it's pretty incredible. There's also a expert falconer, and he's got a show, which you can see, the Ancient Art of Falconry, which is pretty awesome. I have not yet gotten a chance to see that, so I'm hoping to see that this summer. A couple of unknown facts about this castle was that during World War I, it was used as a naval hospital, And from 1965 to 1972, it was actually a boys' boarding school. And now, a family home. They're opened from, I think, about April 1st to October 31st for tours on certain times and hours, and then close the rest of that season for the family. The next castle I'm going to talk about is Snodder Castle. It is seriously amazing. I know I'm going to say everything's amazing because I think pretty much Scotland itself is amazing. This castle is also just incredible. It's featured in my book, The Stolen by the Laird. I had the good fortune to hike there with some friends from Stonehaven. It was a 6-mile round trip hike. Even though that sounds like a lot of miles, it really wasn't, because we were just, you know, walking across cliffs and landscape and looking out at the water. And in the distance, we could see the castle. And every step we took, it got a little bit closer and a little bit closer. And it was just really, really cool. So the castle is situated atop this cliffside. The rocks date back 440 million years. The castle is rich and long in history beyond the fact that it sits on a 440 million year old stone cliff face. The history that I could find started in the 3rd century, where it was first a Pictish fort. And 100 years after that, it became a place of worship. And in the 9th century, there was already a fort built there. King Donald II of Scotland was killed by invading Vikings. In the 13th century, which is when my book Stolen by the Laird takes place, William Wallace captures the castle from the English, and my hero in the book actually helps William capture it. Sir William Keith, who lived at the castle in the 15th century, was the Earl Marischal of Scotland. Keith had a lion's den built in the castle, and when I visited, I was kind of shocked to find this out, and also because the lion's den is not fortified at all. Like, it's literally carved out of the stone and overlooks the entrance to the castle, and from the walkways, it's like 10 feet. Like, a lion could definitely jump and grab you, I think. At least that's what I would think would happen. I don't know. So, with the lion's den, after the countess begged her husband to get rid of the lion, not because she was scared, but because allegedly it was keeping her awake with its roaring, he did, but then he replaced it with a bear. So I'm not so sure how that worked out. Just funny. I know that if my husband decided to keep a lion in our home, I would be moving. So, another couple of cool facts about this castle. In 1562, the castle was visited by Mary, Queen of Scots, and in 1580 by King James VI. And one of the other things I loved about this castle, beside it overlooking the water and having a beach, which beach is always a plus, was that you could climb through it and imagine what it would have looked like all those years ago. A lot of castles which are still lived in today have more of a modernized feel to them, or like an antique-y feel, but when they're not remodeled or anything, they kind of still have that medieval feel to them, even though, you know, there's no roof in most of the rooms and whatnot, but it's just, you know, stone and memories. It's pretty cool. So the next place that I want to talk about is Culloden Battlefield. This was such a humbling feeling when I was there. So Culloden Battlefield is one of the most famous battlefields in the world. It overlooks Inverness in a somber, boggy land called Culloden, where the infamous Battle of Culloden was fought on the 16th of April in 1746. If you visit now, you'll see large stones in place to denote where the clans were buried in one particular spot, as there's too many for individual graves, and also the bodies couldn't always be necessarily identified. There was just so much carnage that day, and since the clans fought with each other, they were sort of like buried in mass graves. It's very unsettling when you're there, very somber. And when I was there, everyone was super respectful, quiet, just walking down the paths through the various places of battle and looking at the different stones with the clan's names on it. As a side note, my friend and I, when we were there, we took a bunch of pictures of the different stones, and we happened to be there close to sunset. Our pictures were covered in orbs when we left, and it was really weird. Like, I guess if you believe in ghosts, then there was definitely some ghosts there with us. But we didn't feel scared or anything like that. It was almost calming. If you've ever been to Gettysburg Battlefield in the U.S., it has much of the same sort of haunted feel. Just so much history and sadness and carnage and death all in one place, it can really weigh heavily on you. So at Culloden Battlefield, there is a large cairn that was erected in 1881 that reads, "The Battle of Culloden was fought on this moor, the 16th of April, 1746. The graves of the gallant Highlanders who fought for Scotland and Prince Charlie are marked by the names of their clans." I'll give you a few more facts actually about this battle because it really fascinates me, and I've been doing a lot of research on it lately for a series I'm writing. The Duke of Cumberland, the son of King George II, led an army on behalf of the Hanoverian government and met with Jacobite forces, which was Prince Charles Edward Stuart, the young pretender, also known as Bonnie Prince Charlie. That was his army. This would be the final Jacobite rising. Bonnie Prince Charlie had been trying all through the Jacobite risings to regain his rightful place in Scotland. The centuries-old battle between England and Scotland for their own king seemed to be waging on, even though after the death of Queen Elizabeth I, the countries were united since her nephew became king after that. But there still seemed to be a battle waging, I think, because Bonnie Prince Charlie felt he had a better link to the throne than King George did. He decided to wage war, and at the time he had the backing of the French and didn't want to just be ruler of Scotland, but all of Britain. So he went to war, and he raised up a lot of money and weapons and men along with the French, and he set out for Scotland. He had been exiled in France most of his life, actually. So when it came to this battle, they'd been battling for a while at this point, various battles, he ignored the advice of his generals to move the fight to a less boggy ground, because Culloden Battlefield is kind of like a marshy area, and the Highlanders, who excelled at guerrilla tactics, really wanted to use guerrilla tactics and not be fighting in this marshy ground, which, you know, will suck on their shoes, suck on the horse's hooves, just in general, not necessarily the best place to fight. But Charles ordered his troops into battle anyway to fight an army that outnumbered them by thousands. It also had many more mounted men than the Scots, the Duke of Cumberland's army, probably three times at least more men on horseback than they did. And obviously men fighting on horseback had an advantage over those on foot. So the entire battle lasted less than an hour. The Highlanders were devastated by the enemy, who used volleys of rapid and accurate musket fire to take down claymore-wielding and musket-wielding Highlanders. You can imagine, while it might have been a scary sight to see a bunch of kilted Highlanders running at you with swords, if you've got a musket, you're just going to shoot them down. And they had a lot more experience with this, having fought in many more battles with musket fire versus the Highlanders, who loved their swords. So even though the Highlanders had been trained by the French to use muskets, they couldn't take it when they were outnumbered by so many bullets coming at them. So thousands perished in this battle, you know, in that initial hour, but even more perished in the fields afterwards from their wounds or outright murder. The Duke of Cumberland was given the name the Butcher for all the atrocities that he committed against the Scots during this and after this battle, following about 6 months or so, where the Jacobites who were able to escape were hunted down and killed.
Hey, history lovers, Eliza here. We're interrupting today's happy hour to let you know that Lori and I host another fascinating podcast with our friend Brenna Ash.
Hey there, this is Brenna. Crime Feast is a true crime podcast hosted by three friends who are obsessed with all things crime.
Each week, join Brenna, Eliza, and I as we serve up a platter of murders, mayhem, missing persons, tragedies, and more.
Feast on notorious tales ripped from today's headlines and resurrected from the past.
Until then, stay safe out there. We don't want you on the menu next.
Now, back to the show. Cheers!
Prince Charles, however, managed to escape back to France after having evaded capture. He was able to escape to the Isle of Skye to avoid the English. Take another sip of my delicious wine. So, have you ever heard the song, the Skyboat song? If you've watched Outlander, then you know the opening song is a modified version of it. This song was actually written about him, the original version, by Sir Harold Bolton in the 1870s, and was adapted by Robert Louis Stevenson a little while later for his own poem, which you're probably more familiar with, which starts with "Sing me a song of a lad that is gone." And then obviously for the Outlander opening, it's "of a lass that is gone." I'm going to read you the lyrics from the original poem. Not going to sing it because I am not a good singer, even though I've been having wine, which might make me a better singer. I don't know. So here we go. "Speed, bonny boat, like a bird on the wing. Onward, the sailors cry. Carry the lad that's born to be king over the sea to sky. Loud the wind howls, loud the waves roar, thunderclaps rend the air. Baffled our foes, stand by the shore, follow they will not dare. Speed, bonny boat, like a bird on the wing, onward the sailors cry. Carry the lad that's born to be king over the sea to sky. Many's the lad fought on that day, well the claymore did wield, when the night came, silently lain, dead on Culloden field. Speed, bonny boat, like a bird on the wing, onward the sailors cry. Carry the lad that's born to be king, over the sea to sky. Though the waves heave, soft will they sleep, ocean's a royal bed. Rocked in the deep, Flora will keep, watch by your wary head. Speed, bonny boat, like a bird on the wing, onward the sailors cry. Carry the lad that's born to be king, over the sea to sky." Isn't that beautiful? I just love it. Even read, like, I didn't even have to sing it. It was just really, really, really pretty. That is my information to you about that famous battlefield and a little bit about the Jacobites and Bonnie Prince Charlie, which I will be having a series come out with in 2020. I know that seems like a far off way from now, but I'm already writing it and it's going to be amazing. I think you guys are all going to love it. So the fourth place I want to talk about after I take this next sip of wine is Mary King's Close in Edinburgh. Has anyone ever been there? This is also a haunted and spooky place, which I really enjoyed visiting. It's a fascinating series of tenement houses and alleys that used to stretch up to 8 stories high and are now all underground. The city built over the Close, built a Royal Exchange over top of it in the 18th century. The Close itself takes its name from a merchant who lived there, Mary King, in the 18th century. Her apartments, or house, if you will, was near the top of the Close, where she lived with her 4 children after she was widowed. A close, in case you're wondering, so a close is an alleyway, and Scotland and Edinburgh cities are all covered with alleyways that they call closes. So in essence, it's basically Mary King's alleyway. So Mary King's Close is one such supposedly haunted place that you can visit. It's steeped in myths of murder and hauntings of ghosts. My friends and I visited this a couple of years ago, and again, I know with the orbs, when the picture was taken, there was a huge orb on my hand, like someone was holding it, which was super creepy because we had just left this little room where they said the young girl who had died haunted that place, and people actually had left hundreds of teddy bears for her, like toys for this little ghost girl. It kind of made me feel like this little girl was holding my hand or something. So the alleyways in Mary King's Close are very steep. I had to basically bend over when I was walking up them. You know, like when you're walking up something super steep and you don't want to fall backwards, so you just like hunch all the way over to make sure that you are not going to fall backwards. Because that's basically how I felt, a little off balance. And I hadn't even had any wine, which I'm going to take another sip right now. This is a lot harder than when it's all three of us. I can take sips while someone else is talking. And now, since it's just me talking tonight, every time I take a sip, there's like a dead silence. So you guys have to be sipping with me when I sip. All right. So back to Mary King's Close. As you're walking up some of the alleyways, you can see a central gutter along the walk, and waste from people's houses was simply tossed out the window to wind its way down the gutters. Living at the bottom of the Close was obviously not the best spot because you are going to get all of the waste from everyone all the way down there. Another cool fact that I really enjoyed when I was there learning was that when they would toss the water out the window, they would shout, "Gardaloo," which is French for "mind the water." Except it wasn't only water that was being tossed out. At the base of the Close was Norlock, which is now Prince's Street Gardens. They filled in the lock a couple hundred years ago. and probably a good idea to have done that. So the clothes' waste all flowed into this lock, and the lock was a common spot for suicide attempts and was the site for witch ducking, also known as a swimming test to see if someone was a witch or not. It was also a place of execution by drowning until it was outlawed in 1685. There's a lot of really sad and interesting stories about that, but I'm not going to go into that today. We'll go into that maybe on a future episode if we could talk about ghosts or something. That would be really cool. While the lock was also used as a defensive measure for the city, it was also used as a smuggling route by criminals. Historians are divided on whether or not drinking water or washing water was taken from the lock, but considering superstitions and all that, I'd say the water was pretty filled with darkness and most people would have avoided it. That's just my take on it. I know that even if I was desperate for water, I would not be drinking water where all the waste went in, and I know lots of people had died. When you're touring the clothes, you can actually still smell some things in the rooms, some foul odors, just because it has sunk into the stone and just, I guess, been underground, so it just held that smell. I'm not sure. But I'm not the only one that says it. Like, you can see people online have said it, and when I was there, people were like, yeah, I can definitely smell that. Just interesting. So in the 1300s, the plague broke out in Edinburgh, claiming the lives of 2/3 of the city's poor. But believe it or not, more of the nobility died than the commoners, which you wouldn't necessarily think. Them having more cash flow for healthier foods, being at a higher level in the buildings where they have less waste and fresher air, but in any case, that was what happened. The plague hit once more in the 1600s. In case you don't know, plague is spread by fleas and rats. The fleas suck, you know, bite the rats and then eat their blood and whatnot. And then when they bite the human, they transfer the disease that way. So rats are the ones who carry the plague and fleas are the ones who spread them. Yay! Symptoms include swollen glands, bulbous pus-filled boils in the groin and under the arm, sometimes on the neck. These are called buboes. Those infected would suffer from severe vomiting, high fevers, and then eventually death. The doctor who served the sick in Mary King's Close in 1645, his name was Dr. Ray. Very, very smart guy. He would dress in a costume that resembled something demonic or even death itself, which is kind of creepy, but the ensemble was actually very smart and I think saved his life. So he would wear thick leather to prevent fleas from biting him, and he wore a long bird-like mask, which he stuffed full of herbs to conceal the horrible smells and also to stave off germs. He saved many lives by scorching the buboes with hot pokers and tending the sick when no one else would. When a house became infested with plague, the victims would hang a white rag outside their door to indicate they needed supplies, and neighbors and friends would leave food and coal or wood or whatnot for them on their doorsteps, and the doctor would also then know that someone in the house had plague and he could come and help them. This is another funny thing that the guy did. Well, not funny, I guess, just really smart. So when the plague broke out and he was like, I can save everyone, I know what to do. He negotiated with the city council to pay a massive yearly fee to him afterwards for basically the rest of his life if he was able to cure everyone. And they were like, sure, yeah, sure, because they did not think that he was going to make it. They're like, yeah, of course we'll pay you £1,200 per year. You're going to die. But he did not die. So he did have to fight to get his money to collect his £1,200 a year, but he did win. So in today's day and age, that would be about £240,000 a year for the rest of his life for just saving those people. So pretty smart. It's like a really great retirement plan there. Although the risk was quite hefty there. So those are the four things I really wanted to talk to you about today. Places that I visited, they're fun and interesting and steeped in history, all have their own little stories, and are included in a lot of the stories that I write myself. And at the happy hour in a few weeks, the girls and I will be sharing some funny stories with you about these places that we visited that I think you'll really enjoy. Sip of my wine, sip of yours. Okay. One of the things that we talk about besides history and wine is the books that we're reading. And this week I read for the second time, because I really, really enjoyed it the first time around, it was a historical romance, Wild Wicked Scott by Julia London. I actually read it by accident for the second time. So I had listened to it on audio and loved it probably a year or so ago. And I guess because I loved it so much, I bought it in paperback, but didn't realize it. I was just like, oh, I love the sound of this book, because I don't generally read the blurbs of books. I know this is really strange, because a lot of people read blurbs to find out if they're going to like the book. I don't. If I'm in a bookstore, I will just grab it by the cover, grab it by the name, the title, whatever. If it's interesting to me or recommended to me by a friend, I never read the back. So that's probably how this confusion happened, because I did not read the back. But it was amazing the second time around. So I will read to you the blurb of this book. Wild Wicked Scott by Julia London. Wicked intrigue unfolds as an unlikely marriage leads to a path of risky desire in the lush green Scottish highlands. Born into riches and groomed in English luxury, Margot Armstrong didn't belong in a Scottish chieftain's devil-may-care world. 3 years ago, she fled their marriage of convenience and hasn't looked back, except to relive the moments spent in wild, rugged Aaron Mackenzie's passionate embrace. But as their respective countries' fragile unity threatens to unravel, Margot must return to her husband to uncover his role in the treachery before her family can be accused of it. Red-haired, green-eyed Margot was Aaron's beautiful bride. Her loss has haunted him, but her return threatens everything he has gained. As the Highland mists carry whispers of an English plot to seize Mackenzie territory, he must outmaneuver her in games of espionage and seduction. But even as their secrets tangle together, there's nothing to prevent love from capturing them both and leading them straight into danger. Oh man, what a good book. I loved it so much for the passion, the intrigue, the mystery, but also because it was really fun to watch two people fall in love when it seemed like a total impossibility. So that was fun. And I highly recommend you get it. It's good in audio and in paper. The next thing on my list to share with you is a book of my own. The one that I picked this week, I wrote it several years ago. I think it released in 2013. It's The Highlander's Conquest. And the reason I wanted to share this one with you this week is because I've been thinking a lot about the main characters that were in this book, because their twin daughters are featured in a book that I'm actually writing right now. So I've been thinking about them because the daughters are not necessarily good little lassies. And I just like, oh, you poor people, like, I will make it up to you in another book, I promise. So I've been thinking about them. So I thought, well, I might as well share their love story, since maybe that'll make them happier, considering what I've done, what I'm doing to them right now. So this is The Highlander's Conquest. What is a Highlander to do when he falls for the daughter of his enemy? Highland warrior Blaine Sutherland has one mission: disguise himself as an Englishman, cross the border, and retrieve Lady Alia de Mowbray. Always up for a challenge, he agrees, pursuing his conquest with vigor and trying to deny the powerful desire that eclipses him each time he touches his charge. A rogue of the highest order and a younger son, he has nothing to offer a lady but a broken heart. Well, what is a lady to do when she cannot trust her heart? Alia is skeptical of the English noble who has come to take her to her father and sister in Scotland, but she pushes her doubts aside. Without a word, in months, she must make certain her family is safe. Then she can return to England to join the convent to which she has sworn to pledge her life. But then her escort reveals his true self. He's a Highlander, and his kisses are more seductive than the sweetest of wines. Surrender never tasted so sweet. Yay! Clearly I like wine, so one more sip for me. So that hero is the brother of my infamous Magnus Sutherland. And in the book I'm writing right now, both of their daughters are getting into it. So just really, really fun. I can't wait for everyone to read that. That is The Highlander's Enchantment that comes out in June this year. I got a question this week from a reader that I thought I would answer. She wanted me to discuss my two writing names, Eliza Knight versus E. Knight. What is the difference? Why do I have two? And what does each author write? So, under my name, Eliza Knight, I do write historical romance, mostly Scottish, various time frames, from medieval to Regency, and I even have a couple of contemporaries that have a little bit of a Scottish twist in them. But that's Eliza. She is romance. And then E. Knight, which is just the Liza chopped off of the E, is historical fiction. So the difference between historical romance and historical fiction is that in the historical romance, a romance is the central story. Although there is, you know, tons of rich history and strife and all of that stuff, the story is also about a love interest. And then with the historical fiction, the story itself is the history and how it affects the characters. So there might be love interests and things like that, but the focus of the story is the history. So that's kind of the difference between those two things. And the reason that I chose to do two is that so people would know the difference. I don't hide that I'm the same person. My website has both Eliza and E's books on it, but it's just a way to denote to readers, like, if you're reading an Eliza book, you're definitely getting a romance. And if you're reading E's book, you're going to have a historical non-romance. So if you ever have any questions, feel free to email me or hit me up on social media, and I will answer those on the podcast next time. I have a question for you guys. How many books do you read in a week? This was a topic I brought up on my Facebook earlier this week, which will be last week for you guys when you listen to this, because I was curious. I have been striving for the last few years to reach 100 books a year, which is about 2 books a week, and I've gotten close, but I haven't quite hit it yet, unless you count my own and critiquing friends and things like that. But my question was, how many books do you read in a week? And it stemmed because my oldest daughter came into my office and asked to borrow a book, and then 2 hours later brought it back, and it's, you know, full-length adult historical fiction. It was In My Hands by Irene Gut Updike. It was a World War II Holocaust historical fiction novel. And so she brought it back a couple hours later, and I thought, oh, it was a little bit too heavy for her. She loves to read those types of books. Her and I both read them. But maybe this one, it was too heavy. But so I asked her, I was like, oh, you didn't finish it? She said, oh, yes, I finished it already. And so I was just really jealous because she can read so quickly. So I was asking people how many books they read in a week, and found that quite a lot of people will read at least one, maybe even 2 books a day. So I would love to hear what you guys are reading and how much you're reading. This concludes the podcast for this week. Our website, if you want to visit us, is historybooksandwinepodcast.buzzsprout.com. And you can find on there the show notes. The show notes are also listed on iTunes. We are also now on Spotify, which is really cool. And next week is going to be Madeline Martin. She'll be talking about some of her favorite places that she's visited in Scotland and giving you some history around those things, followed by Lorianne Bailey the next week, and then our happy hour on March 14th. So we're so happy and grateful for all of you listeners that have contacted us and said how much you're loving the show. We are having so much fun putting it together for you and sharing all of our likes and our worlds with you. So thank you so very much, and stay tuned for next week. Bye.